A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been watching the sequencing on these Israeli drills. He wants to know what it's actually like on the inside of one. Whether the surprise is real. Whether the people running toward the alarm know it's an exercise. How long the planning and the review actually take. And what a country gets out of rehearsing its own worst day.
The timing is the tell. Security forces ran a snap drill modeling. A multi-front attack, commanders ordered to bases immediately. Then days later, health services ran their own parallel exercise. That sequencing isn't two organizations coincidentally choosing the same week.
So we went looking for what it's like on the inside of one of these, and the answer starts with a word that gets thrown around a lot. Surprise.
What actually happens when a country decides to rehearse its own worst day?
The first thing to understand is that surprise in a military drill is a manufactured product. And manufacturing, it's harder than it looks.
Here's the paradox. A surprising drill requires that senior officers don't know it's coming. But someone has to plan it. Someone has to book the transport, coordinate the logistics, clear the exercise area. So the surprise is always partial. It's staged.
So, who's actually being surprised?
The structure in Israel is typically a small planning cell. A handful of officers at the top know it's an exercise. They design the scenario, they set the timeline, they decide which units get alerted and when. The surprise is operationalized down the chain. A battalion commander gets a call at 3 in the morning saying there's been an incident at the northern border. He doesn't know it's scripted. His job is to respond as if it's real.
That's the part that sounds like theater. But it's theater with a purpose.
The purpose is to test whether the response machinery works when people are woken from sleep, when they're running on adrenaline, when they don't have time to prepare their best version of themselves. A scheduled drill where everyone knows the date and the scenario produces a polished performance. You learn almost nothing from it.
So the withholding question Daniel asked, is the drill designation ever kept from participants? The answer is yes. In some exercises, only a small group of senior planners know it's an exercise. Mid-level commanders may be told to respond to a security incident that's actually scripted.
And that's where the October 7 lesson cuts deepest. Because the failure wasn't lack of warning. The warning signs were there. The failure was that the warning signs were treated as a drill, not a real threat.
The drill mechanism itself became a liability.
If your soldiers are conditioned to think that an unusual border movement is probably an exercise, you've created a vulnerability. The real attack exploited the gap between drill assumptions and reality, the assumption that warning time would exist, that the border would hold, that the response would be military first.
So now the snap drills are explicitly designed to break those assumptions.
The recent multi-front scenario is a direct response. The planners are saying, we're not going to rehearse the scenario we're comfortable with, we're going to rehearse the one that broke us.
Let's talk about the planning timeline. How long does it take to put one of these together?
A major home front drill, like Israel's annual Turning Point series, takes months. Scenario design, interagency coordination, logistics, the deliberate injection of scripted events. The injects are the key mechanism. A controller will introduce a new complication at a specific moment. The hospital you were planning to use just lost power. The road you were going to evacuate through is now blocked. Your communications officer is a casualty.
So the injects force adaptation.
They force the participants to make decisions with incomplete information, which is what a real crisis actually looks like. The fog of exercise is deliberate. It mimics the fog of war.
And the snap drill compresses all of that.
The planning is still weeks, not days. Even a snap drill needs a script, a control team, a set of injects. What gets compressed is the participant preparation. They don't get weeks of notice. They get a phone call.
What actually happens on the inside?
Depends on your role. If you're a commander, you're woken by an alarm or an order. You report to a base or a command center. You're fed a scenario that unfolds in real time. Controllers are observing everything. They're injecting failures. They're grading your responses.
grading in real time?
There's usually a control cell that's tracking decisions as they happen. Response times, communication patterns, whether the right people got the right information. The after-action review draws on that record.
What about the medical side? Daniel mentioned the health services drill.
There's a study from Asuta Ashdod Hospital that looked at exactly this, how hospital staff performed in mass casualty drills versus real-world demands. The findings were uncomfortable.
Oh, so.
Measurable gaps between drill performance and real-world demands, particularly around triage decisions and resource allocation under sustained pressure. In a drill, you can pause, you can reset. The scenario ends after a few hours. A real mass casualty event doesn't end. It keeps generating casualties, keeps exhausting your staff, keeps forcing you to decide who gets treatment and who doesn't.
So, the drill creates a performance ceiling.
It tests whether procedures work. It doesn't test whether people can sustain decision-making over days, not hours. Real events are chaotic, prolonged, emotionally corrosive in ways a scripted exercise can't replicate. The study found that drill performance didn't necessarily predict real-world performance.
That's the thing about rehearsing catastrophe. You can rehearse the mechanics. You can't rehearse the feeling.
And the feeling is where decisions break down.
So what's the point of the drill if it can't replicate the real thing?
That's the question Daniel was really asking. What's actually gained?
Let's get into that. Because I think the answer isn't what most people assume.
The real value of a drill isn't the drill itself. It's the relationships and muscle memory built between organizations that don't normally work together.
Police, military, health services, local government.
Each has its own chain of command, its own radio frequencies, its own data formats, its own culture. A multi-front home front drill forces those chains to interlock under pressure, and that's where you discover the incompatibilities.
The incompatible radio frequencies.
The police can't talk to the army. The hospital can't receive the military's casualty data because the format doesn't match. The local government doesn't know who has authority to order an evacuation. These aren't theoretical problems. They emerge the first time you actually try to coordinate.
And you only discover them by doing.
A drill is the only way to test communication systems under load, to identify which agencies have incompatible systems, to build the informal trust networks that matter in a real crisis.
The informal trust networks.
That's the real product. The exercise is the price of admission for interoperability. When a real crisis hits, the commander who knows the hospital director personally, who's worked with her in a drill, makes better decisions than the one who's meeting her for the first time at 3 a.m.
So the drill is a social technology as much as a military one.
It's a social technology. It builds the relationships that the formal org chart can't.
What about the review cycle? Daniel asked how long it takes to review findings in a way that informs posture.
After a major drill, the after-action review typically takes weeks to months. Israel's Homefront Command and IDF units produce detailed reports on response times, communication failures, decision bottlenecks. The reports are thorough. The question is, what happens to them?
And that's where the October 7 lesson cuts again.
The lesson was that after-action reviews can become a substitute for action. Findings get filed. Posture doesn't change. The report is written, circulated, discussed, and then everyone goes back to doing what they were doing before.
The review becomes the ritual of improvement without the improvement.
That's the risk. And it's not unique to Israel. Every organization does this. The after-action review is a genre of bureaucratic writing. It has its own conventions, its own reassuring tone. We identified several areas for improvement. We recommend further study. We'll implement changes in the next cycle.
And the next cycle never comes.
Or it comes, and the same findings appear again.
So what breaks that pattern?
October 7 broke it. The recent snap drills are explicitly designed to test whether the changes actually happened. Not to confirm that the old procedures work, but to break them.
Uncomfortable exercises.
Exercises designed to break assumptions rather than confirm them. That's the shift. Whether it survives the review cycle is the real test.
Let's talk about what drills can prepare you for. The Asuta Ashdod study again.
The study found that drills create a performance ceiling. They test whether procedures work. They don't test whether people can sustain decision-making over days. Real mass casualty events are chaotic, prolonged, emotionally corrosive. A scripted exercise can't replicate that.
So the drill tests the system, not the people.
It tests the system's capacity to support the people. The procedures, the communication channels, the resource allocation. If those work, the people have a fighting chance. If they don't, the people fail, no matter how good they're individually.
That's a reframing. Most people think of a drill as testing individual performance. Can the commander make good decisions? Can the medic triage correctly?
But the real value is testing interagency interoperability. The system, not the individual. A drill that reveals that the police and the army can't talk to each other is a successful drill, even if every individual performed well.
Because the failure is visible before it costs lives.
That's the whole point. You want the failure to happen in the drill, not in the real event.
What about the October 7 inversion specifically? The annual drills had rehearsed invasion scenarios for years.
Israel's Turning Point series has been running for over a decade. It's coordinated by the Homefront Command. It involves police, military, health services, local government. It rehearses missile attacks, mass casualty events, chemical incidents. The scenarios are elaborate.
And the real attack exploited the gap between drill assumptions and reality.
The assumption that warning time would exist, that the border would hold, that the response would be military first. The drills had rehearsed a particular kind of invasion. The real attack was different in ways the drills hadn't anticipated.
So the drill created a false confidence.
Rehearsing the same scenario over and over creates a sense of mastery. You've done this. You know how it goes. The procedures are familiar. And then the real thing doesn't follow the script.
That's the misconception Daniel was poking at, that a successful drill means preparedness.
A successful drill means you're prepared for the drill. Whether you're prepared for the real thing is a different question.
So, what's the alternative? You can't stop rehearsing.
You can stop rehearsing the same scenario. The recent SNAP drills suggest a shift toward uncomfortable exercises, ones designed to break assumptions rather than confirm them.
Whether that survives the review cycle is the real test.
The review cycle is where good intentions go to die. The after-action review becomes a document that justifies the budget rather than changing behavior.
That's a cynical take.
It's a realistic take. The people writing the review have incentives. They want to show that the drill was valuable. They want to justify the resources spent. They want to protect their units from criticism. The review is written within those constraints.
So the review is a political document as much as an operational one.
An understanding that's key to understanding why some findings don't lead to change. It's not that the people writing the review are dishonest, it's that the review serves multiple purposes, only one of which is improving readiness.
What would a review look like if it were designed purely to improve readiness?
It'd be shorter. It'd identify a small number of critical failures. It'd assign responsibility for fixing them. It'd have a deadline. It'd be followed up.
Instead of the 100-page report with 47 recommendations.
The 100-page report with 47 recommendations is a way of avoiding responsibility. If everything is a recommendation, nothing is a priority.
So the drill itself is only half the story. What happens after the exercise ends is where the real lessons and the real failures live.
The after-action review is where the theater happens. Findings written to justify budget requests, not to change behavior.
Let me ask you something. When you were practicing medicine, did you do drills?
Hospital drills, yes. Mass casualty drills. We'd get a call saying there's been a bus accident, expect 30 casualties. We'd set up triage in the emergency department. The mannequins would arrive. We'd go through the motions.
And did you learn anything?
We learned whether the equipment was where it was supposed to be. Whether the extra beds could actually be deployed. Whether the communication with the ambulance service worked. That's real learning. But it wasn't about individual skill. It was about the system.
So your experience matches the Asuta Ashdod findings.
The gap between drill performance and real-world demands is real. In a drill, you know the casualties are mannequins. You know the scenario will end. The emotional load is different.
The emotional load is the part you can't script.
And it's the part that determines whether people can function. A medic who performs flawlessly in a drill may freeze in a real event. Not because they lack skill, but because the emotional context is different.
So the drill tests the system, not the courage.
The drill tests whether the system supports the courage, whether the equipment is there, whether the communication works, whether the chain of command is clear. If those fail, courage doesn't matter.
Let's go back to the recent Israeli drills. The sequencing.
Security forces first, then health services. The fact that they were separated by days strongly suggests coordination. You run the military scenario first, identify the gaps, then run the health services scenario to test the medical response to the same kind of multi-front attack.
So the two waves are connected.
Almost certainly. The alternative explanation that two major organizations independently chose the same week to run multi-front attack drills is implausible.
And the media reporting that commanders were ordered to attend bases immediately.
That's the snap element. The commanders got a call that didn't say, "This is a drill." They were ordered to report. The drill designation was withheld, at least initially.
How long is it typically withheld?
It varies. Sometimes it's withheld for the first few hours, until the initial response is complete. Sometimes it's withheld for the entire exercise, with only the top planning cell knowing. The point is to get the initial response, the waking up, the reporting, the initial assessment, under conditions that resemble a real alert.
And then the reveal.
At some point, the participants are told it's an exercise, usually. There are cases where the reveal is delayed for operational reasons, or where the exercise transitions into a real alert because something actually happened.
That's the nightmare scenario. A drill that collides with reality.
It's happened. A drill scenario that accidentally coincides with a real event. The participants don't know which is which. The controllers have to decide whether to abort.
The fog of exercise meets the fog of war.
And the distinction between them is the whole problem October 7 exposed.
Let's talk about what a major homefront drill actually looks like from the inside. The Turning Point series.
Turning Point is Israel's annual national exercise. It's coordinated by the Homefront Command. It typically runs for several days. It involves the military, police, Magen David Adom, hospitals, local governments, schools. The scenarios vary from year to year. Missile attacks on urban centers, chemical incidents, mass casualty events, earthquakes.
And the whole country participates.
Large portions of it. Sirens sound in cities. Schools practice shelter procedures. Hospitals activate their emergency protocols. Command centers stand up. It's a national event.
What's it like to be a participant?
For most civilians, it's a siren and a shelter drill. You hear the alarm. You go to the shelter. You wait. You come out. It's familiar. It's part of life in Israel.
For the professionals?
For the professionals, it's intense. You're in a command center for hours. The scenario is unfolding. Injects are coming in. You're making decisions, coordinating with other agencies, dealing with simulated casualties. The controllers are watching. It's exhausting.
And it's designed to be exhausting.
The exhaustion is part of the test. A real crisis doesn't give you breaks. The drill tries to simulate the sustained pressure.
But, as the Asuta Ashdod study showed, it can't fully simulate it.
It can approximate the physical exhaustion. It can't approximate the emotional exhaustion of making life and death decisions for real.
So the drill is a partial simulation.
It's a partial simulation that's still worth doing. Because the alternative is no simulation at all, and then the first time you discover the incompatibilities is in a real crisis.
Which is the worst time to discover them?
The worst possible time.
What about the international comparison? Daniel asked about how countries, including Israel, conduct these drills.
The basic structure is similar across countries. A planning cell designs a scenario. Participants are alerted. The scenario unfolds with injects. Controllers observe. An after-action review follows.
The difference is?
Scale, frequency, and the degree of surprise. Israel drills more frequently than most countries because the threat environment is more immediate. The surprise element is more developed. The integration between military and civilian response is tighter.
Because the home front is the battlefield.
In Israel, the distinction between front and home front has always been blurred. The missiles reach the cities. The hospitals are part of the war effort. The whole country is a potential front line.
So the drills reflect that reality.
They do. A country like the United States runs large-scale exercises too, but the threat model is different. The home front is less likely to be a battlefield. The exercises focus more on natural disasters, terrorist incidents, that sort of thing.
The Israeli drills are about war.
They're about war coming to the home front. Multi-front war. Missiles from multiple directions. Mass casualties in multiple cities simultaneously. That's the scenario the recent drills modeled.
and the health services drill days later.
Testing whether the hospitals can handle the load. Whether the evacuation routes work. Whether the blood supply can be distributed. Whether the communication between hospitals and the military medical corps functions.
The unglamorous stuff.
The unglamorous stuff is what saves lives. The heroism is real, but it's the logistics that determine how many people survive.
That's a line that could be the thesis of this whole episode.
The drill is a rehearsal, but it's also a test of systems, of people, of the assumptions baked into both. The question is who's being tested and whether they know it.
And the answer is everyone is being tested, and only some of them know it.
The senior planners know they're testing the system. The mid-level commanders think they're responding to a real incident. The junior participants are just trying to do their jobs.
The layers of knowledge.
That's the structure of surprise. It's not that nobody knows. It's that knowledge is distributed unevenly, and the unevenness is the point.
So the drill is a kind of controlled information asymmetry.
The planners hold information that the participants don't have. The participants' responses reveal how the system functions when information is incomplete.
Which is how it functions in a real crisis.
In a real crisis, nobody has the full picture. The commander is making decisions with partial information. The drill simulates that by withholding the fact that it's a drill.
So the drill is a test of decision-making under uncertainty.
That's its core function. The scenario, the injects, the surprise, all of it's designed to create uncertainty and see how people respond.
And the October 7 lesson was that the uncertainty itself can be weaponized.
The attackers exploited the fact that unusual activity was likely to be interpreted as a drill. The uncertainty about whether something was real became a vulnerability.
So the recent drills are about restoring the ability to distinguish.
About making the response to uncertainty more robust. About conditioning people to treat the unusual as potentially real, not as probably a drill.
That's a fundamental shift in mindset.
It's a shift from assuming it's a drill to assuming it's real until proven otherwise. The cost of a false alarm is inconvenience. The cost of a missed warning is catastrophe.
And the drills are trying to recalibrate that trade-off.
They're trying to move the default setting from drill mode to real mode.
Let me ask you about the review cycle again. Daniel specifically asked how long it takes to review findings in a way that informs posture.
The honest answer is that it varies enormously. A simple drill with a small scope can be reviewed in weeks. A major national exercise can take months to fully analyze. The reports are detailed. Response times are measured. Communication failures are documented. Decision bottlenecks are identified.
And then?
And then the harder question. What changes? Some findings lead to immediate fixes. A radio incompatibility gets resolved. A procedure gets updated. Other findings get studied, discussed, and eventually filed.
The distinction between findings that inform posture and findings that inform a report.
That's the distinction that matters, and it's the one that's hardest to observe from the outside.
So when Daniel asks how long it takes to review findings in a way that informs posture, the answer is sometimes never.
Sometimes never. The review produces a document. The document produces a meeting. The meeting produces a plan. The plan produces a budget request. The budget request produces a negotiation. And somewhere in that chain, the original finding gets lost.
The bureaucracy of improvement.
The bureaucracy is real. And it's not malicious. It's just slow. And in a threat environment that changes quickly, slow is dangerous.
So the recent snap drills are also about speed.
About shortening the cycle, drilling more frequently, reviewing faster, implementing changes before the next drill rather than after the next crisis.
Whether that survives contact with the bureaucracy is the question.
That's the question. And it's the one that will determine whether the October 7 lessons actually stick.
I keep thinking about the Asuta Ashdod study, the gap between drill performance and real-world demands.
The study looked at hospital staff in mass casualty drills. It found that drill performance didn't necessarily predict real-world performance. The drills tested procedures. The real events tested something else.
What was the something else?
The ability to sustain decision-making under prolonged emotional pressure. The ability to adapt when the scenario doesn't match the script. The ability to function when the casualties are real people, not mannequins.
So the drill tests the floor, not the ceiling.
The drill establishes a baseline. If you can't do it in a drill, you definitely can't do it in real life. But doing it in a drill doesn't guarantee you can do it in real life.
The drill is necessary, but not sufficient.
It's a filter. It catches the gross failures. It doesn't catch the subtle ones.
And the subtle ones are the ones that kill people.
In a mass casualty event, the subtle failures compound. A delayed decision here, a misallocated resource there, individually, they're small. Together, they're catastrophic.
So the drill is about eliminating the gross failures. So the subtle ones are the only ones left.
And then hoping that the people on the ground can handle the subtle ones when they arise.
Because they'll arise.
They always do. No plan survives contact with reality. The drill is about making the plan good enough that the improvisation has a foundation.
That's a more honest framing than most.
It's the framing that practitioners actually use. The drill isn't about achieving perfection. It's about building a foundation that makes improvisation possible.
And the improvisation is where the real work happens.
The improvisation is where the real work always happens. The drill just makes sure the improvisation starts from a higher baseline.
I want to go back to something you said earlier, about the drill being a social technology.
The relationships, the trust networks, the informal connections between people in different organizations.
That's the part that doesn't show up in the after-action review.
It doesn't. The review measures response times and communication failures. It doesn't measure whether the police commander and the hospital director now know each other's names.
But that's the part that matters in a crisis.
It's the part that makes everything else work. When you know the person on the other end of the radio, the communication is different. You trust their judgment. You understand their constraints. You make better decisions together.
So, the drill is a networking event with sirens.
That's the most cynical and most accurate description I've heard.
It's not cynical. It's realistic. The social capital built in drills is real capital.
It's real, and it's the part that's hardest to measure and easiest to dismiss.
But the practitioners know.
The practitioners know. That's why they keep doing drills even when the after-action reviews are filed and forgotten. The relationships persist even when the findings don't.
So the drill has value even when the review process fails.
That's the counterintuitive finding. The drill is worth doing even if the formal lessons aren't implemented. Because the informal lessons, the relationships, the muscle memory, those persist.
That's a more hopeful conclusion than I expected.
It's the conclusion that keeps people showing up to drills. The hope that the next one will be the one that makes the difference.
Or the hope that the relationships built in this one will be enough.
That's the real hope. The system will fail in some way. The question is whether the relationships can compensate for the failures.
And the drills build those relationships.
They do. Imperfectly. Partially. But they do.
What about the countries that don't drill? The ones that haven't built those relationships?
They discover the failures in real time. The first time the police and the military try to coordinate is during the actual crisis. The first time the hospital tries to receive military casualties is when the casualties are real.
And the cost of that discovery is measured in lives.
It's measured in lives. That's why countries that face real threats drill obsessively. The drills are expensive, disruptive, and exhausting. But they're cheaper than the alternative.
The alternative being learning in the real event.
Which is the most expensive way to learn.
The drills are a form of insurance.
Insurance with a training component. You pay the premium in disruption and exhaustion. The payout is that when the real thing happens, some of the failures have already been discovered and fixed.
Some of the relationships have already been built.
Some of the relationships have already been built.
Let's talk about the specific recent drills again. The multi-front scenario.
Multi-front is the current nightmare. Attack from Gaza, from Lebanon, from Syria, from Iran. Simultaneously. Coordinated. Overwhelming the response capacity.
The drill modeled that.
The drill modeled the initial response. Commanders ordered to bases immediately. Units mobilized. The scenario unfolding in real time.
Then the health services drilled days later.
Testing the medical response to the same kind of multi-front attack. Hospitals receiving casualties from multiple fronts simultaneously. Evacuation routes. Blood supply. Communication between civilian and military medical systems.
The sequencing suggests a coordinated design.
It's the only plausible explanation. You run the security forces through their response, identify the gaps, then run the health services through theirs. The two drills are parts of a single exercise.
Daniel's instinct was right.
Daniel's instinct was right. The two waves were connected. The separation by days was deliberate, not coincidental.
And the snap element?
The snap element is about testing the initial response, the waking up. The reporting, the first decisions, those are the moments that October 7 showed were most vulnerable.
The moments when the warning signs were misinterpreted.
The moments when the system was slow to recognize that this was real. The snap drill is designed to compress those moments, to force the system to respond before it has time to figure out whether it's a drill or not.
The snap drill is a direct response to the October 7 failure.
It's an attempt to rebuild the reflex that says, unusual activity means respond, not wait and see.
The drill designation is withheld to make the reflex real.
To make the initial response genuine. If you know it's a drill, you respond differently. You're more careful, you're more deliberate, you're performing. The snap drill tries to capture the unperformed response.
The response before the performance begins.
That's the grail. The response that happens before the person has time to remember, they're being evaluated.
That's why the surprise is partial. The senior planners know. The mid-level commanders don't.
The mid-level commanders are the ones whose initial response is being tested. They're the ones who get the call at 3 in the morning. They're the ones who have to decide whether this is real.
Their decision is the data.
Their decision, their speed, their communication, all of it's data. The controllers are watching. The after-action review will analyze every minute.
The drill is a kind of experiment.
It's an experiment with human subjects who don't know they're in the experiment, which raises ethical questions, but the alternative is testing in the real event.
The ethical calculus favors the drill.
Overwhelmingly. The disruption of a drill, even a surprise one, is minor compared to the cost of a failed response.
I want to push on something. The idea that the drill can create false confidence.
That's the October 7 lesson. The drills had rehearsed invasion scenarios for years. The participants had performed well. The after-action reviews were positive. And then the real attack came and the response failed.
The drills created a sense of preparedness that wasn't real.
The drills tested a particular set of assumptions. Those assumptions turned out to be wrong. The drills didn't test the assumptions. They tested the response within the assumptions.
The false confidence came from testing the wrong thing.
From testing the response to a scenario that didn't match the real threat. The scenario assumed warning time. It assumed the border would hold. It assumed a military first response. The real attack broke all of those assumptions.
The recent drills are trying to test the assumptions themselves.
That's the shift. The uncomfortable exercises. The scenarios that break the assumptions rather than confirming them.
Whether that shift survives the review cycle is the question.
That's the question we keep coming back to. The review cycle is where the shift will either become permanent or get filed away.
The review cycle is the part we can't see from the outside.
We can see the drills. We can see the media reports. We can see the after-action reviews when they're published. But the internal decisions about what changes, what gets prioritized, what gets funded, those are invisible.
We're left with the observable behavior, the drills themselves.
The observable behavior suggests a shift is happening. The snap drills are new. The multi-front scenario is new. The explicit focus on breaking assumptions is new.
So something is changing.
Something is changing. Whether it's enough, whether it survives the bureaucracy, whether it actually improves readiness, those are open questions.
They're questions that will only be answered by the next real event.
Which is the cruelest way to evaluate a drill program.
The real event is the only test that matters.
The one you hope never comes.
But you have to prepare as if it will.
That's the whole business. Preparing for the event you hope never happens, knowing that the preparation is imperfect, and hoping the imperfections don't cost too many lives.
That's a heavy note to end on.
It's a heavy topic. But there's something oddly reassuring about the drills themselves. The fact that people are still showing up, still rehearsing, still trying to build the relationships and fix the failures.
The persistence of preparation.
The persistence of preparation. Even after the failure. Even knowing the preparation is imperfect, people keep drilling.
Because the alternative is unthinkable.
Because the alternative is unthinkable.
The surprise is the part that's manufactured, sure, but the manufacturing is sloppier than anyone admits. I spent 18 months writing scenario injects for a national disaster response exercise, early 2000s. Civilian contractor. I was the guy who scripted the terrorist attack on the chemical plant. Everyone in the room knew it was fake except one junior officer who wasn't cleared. He was the only one taking it seriously. The rest of us were watching him like a lab rat. The injects were generic. That was the trick. We wrote them so they could slot into any scenario. Fire, flood, chemical release, active shooter. The wording was vague enough to work for all of them. One time, we accidentally loaded last year's inject set into this year's exercise. Senior Commander delivered a brilliant response. Nobody noticed. The injects were generic enough to work for both. The drill is often testing the scenario, designers more than the responders. We were the ones being graded, really. Could we write something that produced a measurable response? Could we hit the right beats at the right time? The responders were just running the maze we built. The after-action review was where the real theater happened. I sat in on a few. The findings were written to justify budget requests, not to change behavior. You'd see a communication failure get reframed as a resource gap. The fix wasn't a new procedure. It was a new radio system, which cost money. Which the agency wanted anyway. I don't say that as a criticism, it's just how it worked. The review was a procurement document with a narrative attached. But the odd thing is, the drill still worked. Not for the reasons in the reports. The relationships got built. The people who ran through the maze together knew each other afterward. That's the part that saved lives, if anything did. I had four of the old inject cards in a drawer for years. The laminated ones. Gave them to a nephew who was doing emergency management coursework. He said they were hopelessly out of date. Probably right. But the format hadn't changed. The way you write a surprise hasn't changed. The real surprise in a drill is never the scenario.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.